an interview for the Shoe Industry Oral History Project at the Museum LA. The date is Friday, April 30th, 2010, and I'm at the Lamy Wellahan store in Auburn, Maine with Jim Wellahan, and this is Andrea Lumpier. Jim, could you start just by giving me your full name?
Well, it is very full. It's James Francis Xavier Wellahan, and to make matters worse, there are two more just like me. My oldest son is Jim, and he's a wildlife veterinarian, teaches at the University of Florida. And poor devil enjoys being called James F.X. Wellahan Jr. And if you Google James F.X. Wellahan, James Francis Xavier Wellahan, you'll see even more about him. He works for the CDC and all that stuff. And he's a thoughtful guy and a bright guy. And he's a little boy they called James Francis Xavier Wellahan as well. But they call him Xavier, which is a real act of kindness. Who wants to be number three, you know?
Yeah. And so your father had the same name as well?
No, dear. No. Dad was Daniel J. Wellahan.
Okay.
And he, you know, we Wellahans aren't very creative. He passed it on to my brother, who was ran Sebago for years, and he was Daniel J. Wellahan Jr. And Dan had six daughters. So when our third son was born, we hadn't wanted to intrude because an awful thing happened. This is probably not part of the interview, but I taught over in South Africa in 1960, and Dan's wife was expecting me. I waited and waited and waited, and finally had to go because I had to get there. I said, well, Dan, look, it's going to be a girl. I know it's going to be a girl because I'm the first boy in the Wellahan family. He had six daughters after that. Then Kath and I got married and had three sons. So it was a little sensitive. I called Jane. I wanted to honor the name, but I didn't want to. I said, look, we'd like to have a son, call him Daniel. Should we call him Daniel Joseph, or would you? Do you think we should? Well, why don't you change the middle name? That'll be fine. So you're Daniel Thomas.
That's great. Now, where and when were you born?
Long time ago, Lewiston, Maine, 1938.
And so, did you grow up in this area?
Right here. Yeah. My teachers always told me I'd never go far, and I didn't.
And now, you mentioned before we started that your dad was actually in the shoe industry, and then you came in, and your brother came in later.
Dad started the business. Dad was born in 1888.
1888.
Yeah, a while ago, wasn't it?
Right.
And he started the business in 1914. He had gone to his dad had come up to from Holyoke, Mass. When he built the railroad, then worked in the bleachery all his life. And Dad left school, went in the freshman year at Jordan High School, and went to work for I remember the name of the shoe company over in Auburn. He went to work in the stock room there and so forth. Mm-hmm. Then he had a few other jobs, went to work at Peck's department store. He used to start trimming the window. He was the window trimmer and the sign painter. He started trimming the window, there were four major seasonal trims. He started trimming the window on a Saturday night at 10 o'clock with the door closed. Trim all night, keep on trimming all night long, all from one end of the thing to the other. Go up to St. Joseph's Church to Mass, and come back, keep on trimming. And he would finish up by about 9, 10 o'clock that next night, go upstairs into the French department, sack out in the bed, be all ready to go to work in the morning when the store opened up on Monday morning. So after doing that, Charlie Lamy was the shoe buyer at Peck's, and they were good friends. So after a few years, they decided to open up their own store, which they did, which is actually in the original, in the location we have down on Lisbon Street. And so they opened the store there, and they were very happily successful from day one. Dad afterwards wound up going into the Naval Air Force, Navy Aviation, back in World War I, 1917.
Wow.
But they were successful, the thing worked, and a few years later, Hattie Peck, who was a very nice man, asked Dad and Charlie to come back and run the shoe department. They did that. They opened a store in Rockford, opened a store in Portland, and things just developed, and it was good. And then my dad is 50 years older than I. So you grow up and you...
Right, he was 50 when you were born.
Yeah.
So he'd already had this long history.
Yeah, he was 44 when he married, and 45 when my brother was born. And so it was you kind of expect, well, what am I going to do? Well, destiny, and that's true, it was truer then than it is now. Destiny says, I'm going to be a shoe guy. So I became a shoe guy, you know. And I went to Holy Cross, and then I taught overseas for a year in Southern Africa. And after that, I came back and went into the shoe business with Dad. And, while I was waiting ready to go in the Army Reserves, because I figured if I was going to go in the shoe business, but Dad was now in his early 70s, I said, I better give this guy a hand. So I went 6 months active duty, and while I was active duty, I said, you know, really, if I'm going to do this, it's a tricky business, I should get a master's in business administration, because Holy Cross, I studied economics, but it was really more about Latin and Greek and other things than that, and philosophy than anything else. So I went down to Philadelphia, got an MBA in a year and a half, and then came back and went to work, and here I am years later. It's always been fun. And the nice thing about it, I came back to an organization where there were lots and lots of people who were, had been working with the company for 20 and 30 and 40 years. And they were my friends. I'd known them since I was a kid. It was wonderful. And the reason they lasted so long is because they were constantly moving, putting away shoes. Shoes were up on the second floor, some of the first floor, some of the basement down below. It was constant exercise, constant social interchange. And they always had the feeling of making someone feel good. Now then, they might feel good because they were 5 feet tall and they found just the right high heel. And now, we're fortunate, we still have a lot of people who work for us for a long, long time, 20, 30 years. And when you take care of people and you make them feel good, you enjoy what you do. You go home and you feel good. And so it's a...
Yeah, so tell me about what you learned from your dad in those early years when the two of you were together.
Well, Dad at that time had done a wonderful job, and I think there's a real difference between somebody who is 23, 24, 25, somebody who is 73, 74, 75, 76, and I was looking to, as young people always are, develop things, make some changes, and so forth, and Dad was very slow. I used to want to open a store in the main mall when it opened, and Dad said, why would you want to go to work for the landlord? And he was, that was the way he felt about it, and so we didn't go to the main mall until our dad was alive. But Dad had a lot of patience and made decisions very, very slowly. And as a young person, you like to make them quickly. And as I've gone along, I like to make decisions because we have to, because we have to do in a business. But I've learned to make them at the last possible moment when all the information is available. You pull the trigger when you have everything and you've got to do it now. And that's, I guess, it was a combination of working with Dad and going through that that helped. And it's funny, I think being a son in a family business is always, there are frustrations whether you're the father or you're the son. And I always kid that there'll be a spot in my, in the bottom of my foot that will always be sore for having kicked the living hell out of the desk one time after talking with Dad. But that really is not true. He's a lovely man to work with, and you know, it's just a normal sort of thing that you go through these things. And one of the happy moments in my life was when, after I'd been there 5, 6, 7 years, and Dad said, Jim, you did a good job. And that type of affirmation is one of the most wonderful gifts that a father can give a son. And I'm very appreciative of it, and here I am.
Well, tell me about what were the dynamics that built the business and kept it viable and successful over time?
Well, I think the dynamics were probably always very similar. Dad was deeply committed to his friends, to the community, committed to the people who worked there, and always tried to do the right thing. He was a kind guy, and that never gets in the way. And I guess if I've learned something, and you do learn some things, even after you think you have it, you learn things from your dad, and his kindness and his approach to gentleness and approach to life was a very good one. It made for a wonderfully happy life for him. That's, you know, the lessons I've learned from him have helped me have a happy life.
And when you talk about, what was
Lady Willian. And Charlie, I apologize for missing his heart. Charlie was the shoe buyer, and after a few years, he married my aunt. My aunt married my dad's sister. And he was I never knew Charlie, because my aunt lived to be 99 years old. We were very close, Mary Lamy. So when Well, one day, Dad went to going down to church on Sunday morning. He walked down, he lived on Howe Street, walked down to church, and when he got to church, the priest said, Dan, you better go home. Charlie's been taken ill. And we got home, Charlie was dead. Charlie and Aunt Mary lived downstairs, and Dad lived upstairs at 56 Howe Street. And that's where I was born, too. So that was the, and Aunt Mary was just a nice, nice lady. And she never remarried, never had children. She'd been a teacher before, and so the name always survived, but there was, all of a sudden became, Dad took care of my aunt all the way through and was very kind to her, and she was a great lady.
Now, how did your business relate to the shoe industry, the other shoe shops? Were you making shoes yourself, or were you just retail?
We were retailers entirely. At that point in time, there was a real separation, and you were a retailer, you were a manufacturer, so forth. And the idea of vertical integration really hadn't occurred, probably for several reasons. One is that the nature of capital investment was such that, you know, opening a shoe store, you had to have saved up some money, you had to be able to buy some shoes and the whole thing, and it was the way it was. And if you open up a shoe manufacturing shop, you know, your capital is consumed very quickly in the equipment, and materials, and the whole thing. So there wasn't this mass capital to develop vertical integration. And Dad was fortunate, because I think the Depression was just a terrible time for people in the shoe business. Then World War II came along, and rationing, and Rosie the Riveter, and everyone who was here was working and making money, and everyone who wasn't here was in horrors. But when they all came home, we were the only manufacturing power left in the world. Europe had been destroyed. China hadn't been invented yet. And so we had this tremendous capacity to make things. We made things, shipped them out all over the world. And we had this tremendous need, and we couldn't get enough shoes because the Depression had closed a lot of shoe factories. So that was why in 1946 Dad decided to open a shoe factory. And he, and the story is right here, he and Joe Cardot and Willie Bowden got together to open a shoe factory. And a fellow named John Marshall, who grew up in Lewiston on Spring Street and was third and a half cousin of Dad's, was very involved in running the shoe factory. My brother came back, went to retail, and then afterwards went down into manufacturing.
Well, I think it's important to say what the name of the company is that your dad...
Sebago, I apologize.
Sebago, yes. Sure. We don't want to leave that out.
And Dad did a wonderful job with it. And, you know, as we... my brother did a great job with it, too, for many, many years. He opened... All of a sudden, Sebago became a world brand. And he sold it in 2003, and Dan's 4.5 years older than I am, so Dan was a year, maybe a couple of years younger than I was, approaching 70 when he sold it. And I think it was a hard time, because Dan knew that manufacturing in this country was coming to an end. And he liked all the people who worked for him, but they've been there for years. And it was sad. You know, it's funny talking about people there for years. In the stores, we would always have, as I was a kid, people come in, they'd pick up a shoe, they look at the heel lasting, they look at the toe lasting, whatever it was that they did, they look at the stitching, the work, they look at the hand sewing, whatever they did, and they would look at it with great pride. And it was kind of a wonderful thing for them to have this. And they didn't get fabulously wealthy, and it was hard work. And people hand sewed at carpal tunnel syndrome after a while. It's a tough industry, but it's an industry you could feel good about. And people enjoyed it, people came back, they talked about it. And when that was gone, when that was taken away from people, I felt we had just lost something. You take away people's skills, people's ability to contribute to this world, it's a hard thing. And we've done that in many areas.
So did you have any inside workings of Sebago, or were you really on the retail?
Solely retail. As a kid, I'd worked there in the packing room one summer. That was fun. But I was really a retailer, and I came back. Dan had gone into the business, into the manufacturing, and so it was appropriate that he do his thing and I do mine. And we've been friends all through life, and I think we worked together. It might have been harder. That's the way brothers are. Do you have kids?
Yes.
What?
I do. Okay, so talk to me a little bit about where. What you learned as a youth that you were able to put into your business over the years. Is that a fair question? fashion?
See, yeah, it is. And what really happened is that the world changed. You know, when you grow up, mm-hmm. you expect, you kind of know what the world is like. And you don't expect it to keep on changing, but it does change constantly, steadily, and so forth. And after World War II, after the Depression, every store owner on Lisbon Street played golf on Wednesday afternoons and Saturday afternoons. And retail business was good, it just kept on coming, and those, and the factories did well, and everyone was happy, and things were going along well. And then gradually, some people in Italy said, well, you know, we make shoes here. And the value of the lira was way down, and so you go over and buy some shoes a lot cheaper than you can make them here. Mm-hmm. So that was when the whole thing started to change. And it started to bring in Italian sandals and then Spanish shoes and so forth. It started to impact the shoe factories here, first in the women's business, because there were certain things, I mean, the hand-sewn shoes were still very much made, but certain things that just get impacted more and more. And life began to change. All of a sudden, the fair was the first store that opened up where Martins are now. That was this off-price discount store and so forth, and those Mammoth Mart and all these things that came together, and life started to change for the retailers and everything, and became much more competitive. And people started to develop mass retail businesses, and I think of them. There were an awful lot that looked very, very strong and very, very powerful, and as a retailer, you worry about them because you've got a family to feed, you've got people who depend on you in the work and so forth. And we're very lucky. We always tried to work and provide value for company. I mean, the fact that Tom McCann as a company is gone and Lemmy Wilhelm's continues to exist defied the odds. There were so many big operations that came and were here and very strong for a bit, and then they weren't here. And I think some of it is the commitment to people, to the product and so forth, that really does make a difference. And so we've been very lucky, and we've worked very hard to keep it going. And it's funny, after we opened the main mall in 1976, maybe 4 or 5 months after Dad's death, we get a call from people who ran the Boston Shoe, who would have been bought, who were local competitors, nice people, that had been bought by the Wool Shoe Company, which is part of Brown Shoe Company out of St. Louis, and they had been there for a few years, and they were looking to close the Boston Shoe Stores. They weren't doing well with them. So a fellow named Dan Marshall, who was John Marshall's brother, I mentioned here before, been with the company since he was a young man, my dad's third cousin again, a nice, nice man. We went and we talked to the people at Wool Shoe and decided to buy that in the Brunswick store very quickly. I think from the first phone call until the decision to buy was a 3-day process, I think we opened the store 5 weeks after we exchanged said we could make this transaction. So we were there, and it was funny when Dan and I did it. We walked, but then it was only between Judd Marsh and Sears. Those were the two stores. There was nothing else in the mall at the time. So Dan and I walked up and down, and we said, you know, you can fire a cannon from one end of the mall to the other and not hurt anybody. And Dan and I looked at each other and said, there's only one thing to do. Let's go get drunk. Which, of course, we didn't do. But that was our reaction to things. So we were very fortunate. And we opened the store the 1st of December. And getting all the shoes and so forth for it was a very difficult thing. We were very fortunate. I had an old station wagon at the time, and I would fill that thing up, I think, at least 3 times a week with shoes and bring them down to the mall, because all of a sudden the mall caught fire. And our timing could not have been better. It was busy as blazes. And normally you turn your shoe inventory at retail is a very slow turning thing. You'll turn it maybe twice if you're in the women's fashion business. You may turn it 3 or 4 times, but if you're in the family shoe business, it's a 2 times turn. Mm-hmm. We turned a whole inventory 1 time in the month of December in the main mall when we opened it up, and we thought we were going to be closing Cook's Corner in Brunswick shortly, because that was a smaller store. Mm-hmm. But that has continued to be a very good store and done very nicely over the years. We've had to relocate it in the same mall a couple of times, but it was the same strip center, but it's been a very good store for us. So that was one of the things that worked out well. You know, luck is always important. Over the last few years, we've had some funny things happen. We had We were in the Albemarle, as you know, and there we were one of the original tenants. We've been there since the mall opened, and in every study, they said after CVS, you're the major reason people go inside the mall. They come to the mall for pennies, and they go to CVS, and they go to Lemmy William. But so we had talked to them about doing a redo in the mall, and we wanted to put an Elijah store there that would open both front and back. And we had comfortable relationships, and we worked also with a lady by the name of Liz Ryan. And she, at that point, then Equity Properties, who owned the mall, mm-hmm. turned over the leasing to General Growth Partners. And Liz worked for General Growth, and then she stopped in to, mall manager stopped in to see Dawn, who's next door here one day, and said, this is back 5.5 years ago, says, by the way, guys, you've got to leave here in 30 days. Your tenants at will and so forth. And apparently there have been side transactions. The only thing I can gather, and Liz took some money to get rid of us and put another shoe store in there. And that was the dealing with Liz. So we've had that that was a challenge. We were fortunate. Jim Pittman's been a wonderful guy. Had a lot of support from the community. We moved off location, moved into here, and we're doing more business than we ever did before.
This is a unique location. It's a great separate location from everything, but it's near everything.
Well, Jim Pittman had this all set for a restaurant, mm-hmm. the same size, same everything, all zoned and all approved, and just right for us. And then the restaurant pulled out and couldn't do it. So we were off location for 6 months, and Jim built the building for us. And he's been Jim's. Yeah. I don't know if you know Jim. He's a wonderful guy.
What's his last name?
Jim Pittman.
No.
Runs Jim's Auto Sales. Nice, nice guy.
Yeah.
Then we had to relocate our Augusta store 3 years ago when that was bought. And again, we were tenants at will. It was downtown Augusta. We were very fortunate. It came in the most wonderful location up on Weston Avenue. And that store is now doing more business than we ever did in the main mall. So that's worked out well. And 2 years ago, we were negotiating, you know, what are we going to do with the main mall? These comes to an end. 2.5 years ago, it started. And we gradually worked out an arrangement that we thought would work for us. And then Liz Ryan, who was working for General Growth Partners, said, let's have coffee. She says, you know, that deal we worked out, that's too good a deal. We've got to charge you more rent than that, and we've got to, we can't give you that sort of construction allowance. So we said, oh, Liz, nice to see you again. And we found another location outside the mall, and we're doing more business outside the mall in Scarborough than we did then. So I think some of the lessons you learn, you go as you go along, because the world keeps changing. A lot of things change. Retail locations, types of stores, relationships with how much you can trust corporate America, all these things, they all change.
Right. Right.
We've been very fortunate, and our business is, last year was the best year we've ever had, and I think this year is set to beat it by quite a bit, so we're very fortunate. Focus on some other things.
I don't want to miss anything in terms of the history of your shoe business. Is there anything that I haven't asked?
Only about the founding of Sebago, and there, Dad did a wonderful job, and my brother did a wonderful job. Now, if you want, you can look this over, and it's just a nice book that's printed up after they sold by Tim O'Donovan, who was the Wolverine president. I would like it back because it's kind of a family thing.
Oh, absolutely.
And the other thing we've always done is we've tried to build our own shoes, and we have a very small wholesale business as well where we sell four-siders. Tragically, they're made in China, mm-hmm. and we sell ice boaters to other retailers, and they're made in China as well. Now, an interesting thing is happening in China, in that the Chinese factories, who had to downsize during the worldwide recession, mm-hmm. are now working very hard to come back up to build as many shoes as they can again. But they can't hire the workers, because the same thing that happened here in Lewiston Auburn is happening in China.
Mm-hmm.
Happened in Italy. People are going into higher paying industry in China, and the factories are all of a sudden buying things. It takes a month longer, a month and a half longer for delivery and so forth. So there's some real problems. You know, the industry keeps changing and evolving. And a lot of the industry now goes out and go to Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
and life keeps on changing.
Yeah.
And I guess that's about all. Is there anything you wondered about when you were talking that? As we talk, anything you wanted about Andrea?
One of the things that we like to capture in these interviews is a sense of what the Lewiston Auburn community was like in the years that you were growing up, in the 40s and the 50s.
A wonderful community. And it still is a wonderful community. But it was some of the things I think were that it was people lived in town,
mm-hmm.
and worked in town and didn't need a car. And I, all my friends were, I went to St. Pat's and I went to St. Thomas, which were both inner city schools, and a lot of my friends lived in apartments in downtown Lewiston, and the families were all together, and that was very helpful. And it may not have always been the Ozzie and Harriet, but it was easier for the kids, there was less of a, no one commuted from Green or Minot or Sabattis or what have you. But gradually, as the housing stock got older, and the city failed to invest in recreational activities for the young people in town, I mean, it did what it could, but maybe it could have done just a bit more. People said, let's get the Blazers out of here. We're left with this old housing stock that people want to avoid. So all my friends moved out to Sabattis, where taxes were cheaper because they didn't have to plow for the hospital, or the courthouse, or all these things that we have as a service center. But they all of a sudden now have two cars. They've got to pay for them, they've got to commute. It's a much more, when everyone knew everyone, everyone worked together, it was kind of wonderful. Because down Lisbon Street, you'd be in the stores, you'd be in the street, you saw nothing but friends. When that came to an end, the community broke up a little bit. It's still a wonderful community, but there isn't the closeness, the warmth that there was, and that's sad.
Now, when you were growing up, were you in a neighborhood where there were lots of kids around? And what did you do for social activities? I'm talking about going outside. Did you play ball?
What you did on Saturday mornings, you go down to the corner lot, and everyone would kind of, all the kids would kind of congregate there. And there wasn't the worry, despite the fact of what we've seen happen in the Catholic Church, there wasn't the worry about pedophiles that there seems to be today. I'm not sure to what degree we were innocent and to what degree that's changed. We may never know those numbers. Mm-hmm. But kids were free. I walked to school. Kids were free to walk to school. There was no need for school busing. I biked to school later on. And the streets were safe. And we go down and meet on the corner lot and first two kids start playing pass, and the third kid come along and be playing pass, and somebody bring a bat, and they start playing pepper, start playing infield, and gradually the game would start. And the game would keep on going until there were 14 on one side and 15 on another. Then they start going home for lunch, and they come back, and the game would keep going. And at the end of the 343rd inning, we call the game off, you know. So it was fun. The football, it was different sports at different times, and it was the way it was. At St. Thomas, you know, football practice was up on top of the hill behind the arena where the arena is now and so forth. It was great, and the games were on Bartlett Street in the football field there. And it was fun going back there when my kids were young because I coached soccer, and some of my other friends who had gone to high school with also coached soccer, and we had three kids, and three of our kids were on the same team one time. It was just fun being there, remembering all these wonderful things. It's always been a wonderful town.
Right.
I still love the town.
And when you were like teenage years, were there places to go hang out and have a soda or go to dances? Where did those things happen, or did they happen in your group?
Well, they happened. We talked about sodas. Jimmy Harkins, a drugstore in College Street, when I was a little younger, was always a great place to go to have an ice cream soda or an ice cream frap. And it was the drugstores had this wonderful old high chairs and a high marble top counter and so forth. That's kind of a wonderful spot. But we used to, the Y always had weekend dances, and we'd go down and go to the Y, and at Y dances, I think they were Saturday, it could have been Friday, but I think it was Saturday night, and you'd go and you'd meet all the kids from all the school and see, you know, going to St. Thomas, the boys were here, the girls were there, so you had to look at all these girls, and all those Yale girls were pretty cute, you know, and those Lewiston girls were pretty cute, so we had some fun. Then, of course, there were dances at St. Thomas, the old St. Peter's School, there were dances for the St. Thomas kids, and that was the only time the boys and the girls at St. Thomas ever got together in those days.
Right.
And some of the things were different as I brought up my kids. Boys played sports, girls didn't. And as my kids grew up, they played sports, they were involved in track and cross country, among other things, and skiing. And those were all sports that girls did as well. And it was kind of a wonderful thing. They got to be friends. And girls and guys, they knew each other as people as opposed to, wow, she's kind of cute.
Yeah.
And it was a much healthier thing, I think. So there have been some good things happening in the last 50 years, as well as everything else we could lament, you know?
Right. Is there anything else that I haven't asked you that you think is important to add?
We haven't gotten into global warming. We can talk about that. I will tell you, just brag about one thing, by the
way. Sure.
Kidding about that. We do take that very seriously, and I was at a Earth Day promotion with Mike Rattel, who's a geologist at Bates, and had my son Dan's senior thesis advisor.
And who is that?
Mike Rattel.
Yes.
And do you know Mike?
I know his wife Julie.
Okay. So we the rate of sea level change in Maine has moved from, I think, 1.2 millimeters per year to 1.8 to 3.2 over the last 10, 15 years. Yeah. So we're seeing global warming as a real thing. We're seeing more storms, all those things. As a company, we're doing our very best to cut our emissions. Between 2004 and 2008, we cut our carbon emissions by 20%. Figures aren't in for 2009 yet. We'll be doing that in the next month or so. But the new store in the Maine Mall is one-third larger than the new store in Scarborough, which replaces the Maine Mall, is one-third larger than the Maine Mall store.
Mm-hmm.
And we are currently using one-third less energy in the new store. We've worked at it very hard. And as a company, we're committed to cutting our carbon emissions by at least 50% by 2020. Mm-hmm. And I think we'll beat that goal in terms of time and everything. Yeah. So
that's great. That is an important piece
critical.
To add to that.
Critical.
Great, thank you.
Andrea, nice talking to you.